Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Santo, a mild obsessive when it comes to eating and language and the genealogy of food culture patterns. And for this last episode of season one of the podcast, I have decided to consider the not-so-humble substance that is pudding. Yes, pudding. It is our shared dessert today on the show, a sweet and savory end to this extended buffet of ideas. So get your spoons ready, but also your sausage casings and your steaming basins, as well as your etymological dictionaries. Actually, before you do all that, figuratively or actually, direct your earballs towards this. That was the sound of impurity, of pluralistic realities, and of the absolute truth suddenly looking and sounding quite different than it did just a while ago. It was, in fact, episode one of this podcast, time-shifted to high speed and representing the only real reality of our collective existence, that nothing really stays still or accurate or stable for very long, despite what we think we know to be true and indelible. Quite normally, we humans like to think we understand things, and that we understand them correctly, and that those correct understandings remain so over a long enough period of time that we can reliably refer to them as truth. Generally speaking, over relatively short timelines, particularly those that exist during human lifespans, that sense that our truths are stable actually plays out relatively well. Taking a longer view of time, though, it becomes pretty obvious that truth changes, that perspectives evolve, that new information or feelings or understandings emerge and replace what we historically thought was correct. That's the way of things over human history, but in the short term, we often lose track of it. And in the much longer term, it's very normal that truth changes. So why all this focus on the theory of knowledge and knowing in a season-ending food podcast episode focused on pudding? What do pudding and evolving truths have to do with each other? Well, kind of a lot, actually. The word pudding probably has its roots in the Latin word botellus, meaning little sausage. It's also connected etymologically to the French dish boudin, a sausage that we call black pudding or blood pudding in English. Around the year 1300, there are English language references to a dish called pudding, which was, quote, a kind of sausage, the stomach or one of the entrails of a pig, sheep, etc., stuffed with mincemeat, suet, seasoning, boiled and kept till kneaded, unquote. Later in the 14th century, a porridge-like stew called frumenti was documented. It was a kind of sweet dessert made from boiled grain meal, milk, and dried fruit. Over the next two centuries, the word frumenti faded away from our lexicon of food and again converged with the word pudding. It eventually came to mean any one of a number of sweet or savory dishes made of seasoned, cooked, chopped up stuff, which was then stuffed into a casing or bowl and boiled or grilled or steamed. Pudding is therefore basically a mixture of different bits and bobs, probably mostly inexpensive ingredients, that come together to form a relatively humble dish without much textural distinctiveness. It's a practical food. It's filling and flavorful. It's everything from a sweet, smooth, custard-like dessert to a dense, stodgy, steamed, dried fruit, dense, cakeish blob, a loose mass of coagulated seasoned pig's blood, a spicy ground flesh and fat and meat stick on a barbecue, or even a highly processed hot dog in a bun, all slathered with yellow mustard. Today, the word pudding reflects this very diverse history. In the UK, pudding is the generic word for the sweet end of a meal. In Quebec, pudding is a dessert made with cheap, easily accessible ingredients and resembling nothing so much as a British steamed pudding like spotted dick or sticky toffee pudding. In the Anglophone world, pudding is generally thought of as coming from a Jell-O packet or an individual cup and being flavored with vanilla, chocolate, or butterscotch. And yes, those dense and delicious boudin noir and boudin blanc made with animal bits and stuffed into a pig gut, they are also puddings, both black and white. So back I come to the idea of impurity and pluralism and the ways that pudding gives us an example of how to take a less rigid approach to truth when it comes to food. Or when it comes to everything, for that matter. The ways in which pudding has evolved over 800 years, both linguistically and gastronomically, gives us a great example of how changeable our world is. Our reality is always evolving. It's the result of all the things in our local orbits interacting and producing effects that we then perceive and interpret. That's all anyone can know. And even when we share these perceptions and interpretations with each other, and when a bunch of us come together to share them in a larger meta-understanding of the world, we're still only experiencing what that social group can collectively perceive. It's not everything, and it's not the absolute one and only truth. It is a truth, but it's also a truth that's going to look a little different the day after tomorrow, and even more so in a few centuries. All this to say, while honesty and integrity and accuracy are super important ideals that we must absolutely continue to strive for, assuming that something is 100% pure truth is likely to get us into trouble. It comes up over and over again when it comes to politics and culture, and it certainly keeps coming up when it comes to food. Think of all those medical and corporate recommendations, the good and the bad things to eat, the miracle diets and the superfoods. However true any of these truths are, they're not going to be here forever. And even if one sticks around for a while, the history and evolution that brought it to the fore were probably pretty fluid themselves. Things are always relative, neither totally objective nor totally subjective. And every so-called food reality is relational. Relationships were what episode one of this podcast was focused on. And that's where I'm ending up today, trying to make a meal of making a meal of it by closing things off with the beautifully indeterminate substance that is pudding. Anyway, as the expression goes, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. In other words, the test of a thing's nature is not perceivable from the outside. You have to stick a fork in it and then stick it in your mouth to know what it's really made of. So, stick a fork in the conversations that are still to come, and then chew on them for a while, and maybe then decide what this episode was made of. My pudding-ish guests today come at food from quite different perspectives, though at the same time, they also share some pretty common ideas about testing things out, reflecting on the results, and communicating them with others. As they both express, having an understanding of physics and chemistry and biology can make cooking and eating more interesting, though there's also more to food than science and technique. Both are teachers, both are makers, and both will, I hope, help you understand both pudding and purity in greater depth and detail. Then later, Maxime and I look back a bit as we enjoy a nostalgic treat during the Stick This In Your Mouth segment. And to close things off, I take a few moments to respond to some of the questions that the food questionnaire respondents posed to me. First up, Dr. Richard Hartel. Richard is a professor of food engineering with the Department of Food Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research focuses on phase transitions in foods, particularly sugar confections, chocolate, and ice cream, and he teaches courses in manufacturing and preservation, as well as candy science. He also coordinates various industry courses, including on confectionery technology, enhanced gummies and jellies, and a nutrition bars class. Richard, first of all, thank you so much for joining me on this strange adventure into the discussion of the science behind pudding. I'm very excited to talk to you about your knowledge. And I'm actually curious because you have degrees in physics and agricultural engineering, and your work now is largely in the science of food, the chemistry and the physics of the structural science of how food products come into being. But can you tell me about the connections between your education and what you're doing now?
Sure. Actually, my PhD, even though in agricultural engineering, was food engineering. So it's one of the subdisciplines of ag engineering, although I tend to think of myself more as a chemical engineer. And then a physics background gives me an understanding of the forces that apply in foods and the kind of responses that our mouth generates as we chew and eat things.
Chemistry and physics are, of course, fundamental to how food comes into being, right?
Yes, absolutely. So we teach a food science degree here, and it's primarily focused on chemistry, although it also includes physics and microbiology and other things as well.
So your book, Food Bites, is divided into these incredibly accessible short chapters. They're both very amusing and very informative, and it talks about the food science behind a lot of the different foods that we eat on a regular basis. What was the inspiration for the book, and why do you think it's important for people to understand the science behind their food?
Well, essentially, I was writing those columns for the local newspaper. So every month I would have a column that came out talking about the science of food. And at some point, I decided that I would compile them into a book. We added a few more topics to the chapters that were columns that turned into this Food Bites book.
Do you think that folks think about the science much when they're eating? Do you think your articles have helped them think about that?
I think that most people just eat to fill their mouths and fill their stomachs. But I think there are a lot of people that do consider what, you know, what's going on in there. I think in particular, it's true with cooks and people that are in the kitchen making things and thinking about, well, why did that just change? You know, why did I get a brown color here? Why did I get protein coagulation, that kind of stuff? So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that are interested in it.
And certainly with the new waves in avant-garde cuisine and molecular gastronomy, more attention about the science of cooking has really been brought to light. Do you think that's also contributing to some of the interest or potentially some of the need for people to know more about what's going on inside their food?
Again, I see a range of interests, people that really want to understand what's going on and other people that just shovel it in.
Well, your chapter in the book on chocolate pudding was, of course, why I wanted to talk to you about this. It's both, again, very informative, but also incredibly funny. Can you tell me about that particular chapter?
Yeah, so that I kind of outlined it in the chapter that it started from this kid in my class asking if we could make him a whole bunch of chocolate pudding. And once I found out what he really wanted it for, which was pudding wrestling, I decided that probably that was not something that we should be supporting with campus facilities.
But so he wanted a really, really large quantity of chocolate pudding.
He did, yes. Enough to fill up bathtubs full of chocolate pudding.
And so he had ultimately had to go to another source to find his pudding, or do you know if it ever happened?
No idea what he ended up doing, but I think it was even for a fraternity party. So it was, yeah, not something that I thought we could support.
But it is a great image. And it's almost inspiring that a kid who wanted to actually have a pudding wrestling competition got interested in maybe the science of pudding. It is, again, quite simple, but also kind of fascinating because pudding has this weird semi-liquid, semi-solid consistency. It's got an incredible mouthfeel. We seem to respond as humans to that kind of soft, intermediate texture. What is it about the food science behind pudding that gives it that unique consistency?
So pudding would be something that in the food science field we would call a soft solid. Mm-hmm. So it's got enough structure that it doesn't flow very easily, but once you apply some forces, it flows pretty easily. And that soft structure is generated by the coagulation of the starch granules, of the starch in the starch granules. So the classic way of making a chocolate pudding is to make a slurry of starch granules, cornstarch or something like that, add a little bit of sugar, add a little bit of cocoa powder, and then cook it. In the lab that we were doing that generated this idea, we use a steam injection cooker. So instead of just cooking it on the stove where it might take 15, 20 minutes to get the starch to gel, we can make that happen within seconds just simply because we have high temperature, high pressure steam being injected into it. So we have our starch slurry coming in one place, high pressure steam in the second, and they mix together. And within 30 seconds, we've got warm pudding. And so that process is, you know, scientifically is actually quite interesting. But again, the topic of materials like that is what we call soft matter, soft solids.
Sounds like a lab that I would enjoy spending some time in.
And it's interesting to see it, but of course, then you get to eat it. Right. And that's a lot of what food science is.
The tasting of it afterwards,
yep.
making sure that the science worked out.
Yeah.
So what happens at the molecular level with those starch granules and then the starch turning into the soft structure?
The starch granules themselves are these little particles that the plant makes, and it's the source of nutrition for the growth of the next plant. But they pack the starch molecules. There's two types, the amylose and amylopectin. They pack them into this really dense granule. So when you pour out a container of cornstarch, you get this white powder. That's all individual cornstarch granules of a few microns in size, packed of these amylose and amylopectin molecules. And when you cook them, under certain conditions with high water content, the water penetrates into that granule, causing the individual starch molecules to come out and release. And so instead of a bunch of different little particles, now you've got this kind of soup of amylose and amylopectin molecules. And then when it cools down, those molecules form a gel.
Okay, so it's all about those dry, effectively granules of starch exploding and releasing their contents and mixing under heat and moisture conditions to become this thickened product.
So pudding is nothing more than a starch gel.
Okay, and that, so that's different from, for example, custard, which is thickened with eggs to make it, to give it that similar kind of thickened consistency.
Right, and they have different texture, different mouthfeel properties. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very similar in soft, solid type matter though.
So then when we're making pudding not from scratch, but from a package, and there are generally two kinds, there's the instant kind and the kind that you have to cook. I always hated the kind that you had to cook because it took more time and I just wanted to eat the pudding quickly. Yeah. But what's the difference between the instant kind that doesn't take heat and the kind that you need to actually cook over the stove?
So the process of cooking it that we do on the stove is what releases those starch granules. Basically, the companies that make starch do that process for us in their plants, and they make an instant starch, which is essentially they've made the starch super ready, but then they dry it so it looks like granules again. But now it's not packed as dense and water can penetrate even at room temperature.
Okay, so that cooking process has taken place. It's just that we're not doing it ourselves.
Yep.
Fascinating. Who would have thought there's so much depth to a bowl of pudding? But going sort of in a different direction, because pudding is a word that historically has evolved over many, many, many millennia to mean different things. In British English, pudding can refer to a dessert, a steamed pudding, or even a savory pudding like black pudding, white pudding that are actually made out of pig's blood or other kinds of blood mixed with other starches. So that's a very different kind of pudding. But I'm wondering, are there linkages at the food science level between the kind of puddings that are more like sausages and the puddings that are more like custards?
To some extent. I mean, they're all gels of some sort. It's just depending on what the molecule is that's forming the gel, whether it's protein or in our case, starch. But basically, they all fit in the same category of soft solids that kind of stand up against gravity because these molecules are interacting together.
Okay, so even though they look different and we think of them in very different terms, savory puddings and sweet puddings, they are connected not just by etymology, but also by science.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Do you have a favorite kind of pudding?
I like chocolate pudding.
It is one of my favorites. I eat it rarely, but when I do, it brings me straight back to childhood. It's a food that's very, very connected to comfort. And I think that's probably one of the reasons a lot of people still seem to be attracted to it, even though it's not part of our regular diet.
Great.
Well, thank you so much. This has been both informative and fun to chat with you about pudding, the science, the history, and of course, the deliciousness.
Happy to help.
Thanks so much. Take care.
And for more about Richard and his book, Food Bites, The Science of the Foods We Eat, see the links in this episode's show notes. My second conversation is with Nick Amberg, a college instructor, food maker, and photographer. Nick is the source of two of the taste treats that Maxime and I have enjoyed during Stick This In Your Mouth segments, the whipped lardo we ate during the fat episode, and the cured duck breast we had more recently for meat and sustainability. But he's also a connector and relationship builder, and a lot of the other people you've heard on Making a Meal of It have also passed through his kitchen and sat at his tables. As you'll hear, Nick thinks a lot about many things, and food is just one of them. Well, Nick, thank you so much for being here. I am very glad to be talking to you about sausages during an episode about pudding.
My pleasure, I think.
We'll see where it goes. So, tell me about your life in sausage making.
I think the beginning of making those sausages was just the idea that I love to make things. And as I'm very impressionable, someone says, why don't you try making sausages? So I made some sausages. No, actually, let me go back. Back then, which would have been probably getting close to 20 years ago, there were a bunch of things that came together that conspired to have me make stuff. And the sausages was kind of a segue from smoking things. And the smoking things had begun because I'd watched a show on the Food Network, believe it or not, back when they actually made things on the Food Network. Alton Brown had a show called Good Eats. Mm-hmm. He had smoked something and built a smoker out of gym locker.
That's bringing a whole lot of different smells and aromas into the smoke.
And I'm like, substance. I could do that. That would be cool. So I built a smoker out of old wine boxes. Mm-hmm. First thing I smoked was salt, and then smoked different things. And then obviously it's like, oh, wait, maybe I could make sausages and smoke sausages. And my parents, or my mom in particular, was Eastern European. As a new North American, had this thing that she wanted her kids to eat North American food. So she was making these horrible pizzas and stuff, but then occasionally she'd make these amazing Eastern European dishes. And so part of me making sausages is thinking about sort of the culture I come from. Part of it is this sort of watching this Food Network thing, going, oh, I could do that because I'm a maker. I need to be making things. It's a creative outlet. And then people ate some and he's really good. And then a mutual friend of ours, Andrew, was like, you should do this. We should do this. And so we kind of made a few batches and people came like, I want these. So I think the first time I made a batch of sausages was like 10 pounds and then 30 pounds and then 60 pounds and then 240 pounds.
So you've been evolving and growing since the beginning, from smoking to small quantities of meat to massive quantities of pig intestines running around your kitchen.
Yeah, which of course then has turned into charcuterie and all kinds of other things.
So is your inspiration for the taste and the flavors, because one of the things I really admire about your sausages are the way that you put flavors together, some unusual things, some references to international cuisines. Where does that, is that partly from the Eastern European influence of your mother, or is that other places?
I think I've learned over the years, things just make sense. Mm-hmm. Like you think about something, what goes with something else, you go, oh, that would be really cool. Let me try that. So in theory, some of these things make sense. And then obviously when you put them together, sometimes it doesn't work. But for the most part, it's really weird. They kind of go, yeah, this so makes sense.
Do you test your recipes before you prepare a batch of 150,000 sausages?
For the most part, but a lot of it's up in my head. To be honest, a lot of it too is I'll sort of reference other things. Like I'll find a sausage recipe and go, okay, that could be cool. Wait, no, that doesn't seem right. What have you replaced that with this? Often also when you see sausage recipes, that's the other thing that's quite different, is they're for small batch. You know, you make 2 pounds of sausage and I'm always thinking about how could I scale this up to 60 pounds. Mm-hmm. So a sausage I just made was a Hmong sausage. And I found a couple of recipes, thought about what those ingredients would be, decided that making them over the top spicy might not be the way to go. So you're scaling that back, but you're also scaling up to 60 pounds. So you're including fish sauce. Wait, I'm not putting 3 liters of fish sauce. Okay, so what can we do to replace that with something else?
And so you're continually thinking and adapting and mixing and testing. Sure. and scaling back, scaling up. Yeah. So really, I mean, it's one of the reasons that at one point in our history, I asked you to make a sausage that tasted effectively like a banh mi, a Vietnamese sandwich. For my side of it, it was a performance piece. It was about streetscapes and taste of Montreal and a whole bunch of other stuff. But I remember that you and I had some kind of tricky conversations about that particular sausage. In the end, it was absolutely amazing and delicious. Someone just referenced it to me about a week ago. They remembered it from 10 years ago. But what was your memory of our first collaboration?
Well, it's really interesting. I remember it as you saying, I want to include elements that incorporate the history of immigration on Saint-Laurent Boulevard all the way up. I remember at one point you were saying things like, well, we could put in mayonnaise and raw pork and cooked pork and all these. I think my question, which probably came across as a little bit like, well, what the hell, was, do you want this to be a theoretical sausage or do you want to be able to eat the sausage? But it was an important question, right? In the sense that if it was theoretical, then and not really being made or made as a performance piece that people might like just taste and go, ooh, we're young. But if it wanted to be a sausage that was like consumable, then in my then also not as evolved experience as now, I probably bristled at a few of the things out of fear that, you know, I might poison somebody. Or so, yeah, it was an interesting collaboration for sure. It was fun. And in the end, I found the old recipe. And so what evolved from things that probably would have been a little difficult to eat. I found the recipe that was smoked paprika, caraway, black pepper, buckwheat honey. I'm still trying to figure out why that was in there. Apple cider vinegar. Oh, and pickled diced carrots.
Well, yeah, and that was exactly the idea, because it was about this idea that banh mi was a better iconic food for Montreal than smoked meat or bagel, just because of the blendedness of cultures, of colonialism, of Frenchness and other things. That was the inspiration for mayonnaise, cooked pork,
smoked pork or barbecue pork, and then the pickled vegetables. Fabulous to hear that actual recipe read out loud, because indeed it was a banh mi. I was hoping you would invert. I actually remember asking you if you would put bread on the inside of the sausage. You said, no, filler. I refuse to put filler on
the sausages. Oh, I remember that.
And I was like, no, but it's conceptually. I think that's when you said, is this a theoretical sausage? And it was, you know, I served it, I think, with sauerkraut. So it was kind of a Bauernschmaus, but with a banh mi-inspired sausage. Anyway, it was a freak show, but it was absolutely delicious. And it was one of the things that I really respected you about, because you pushed back on the artisanship, but you were willing to go with the artship of it, the sort of artness of what I was trying to do.
I think what I really appreciate about that collaboration, thinking back about it, it probably had quite an influence on the way I thought about sausages afterwards too, going, oh, I don't have to like follow somebody's recipe. I can try and do things like having fun making a borscht sausage, going, well, you know, borscht is this thing where probably 1,000 different recipes for borscht, but, you know, some of them have meat in it. So what happens if I invert that and put all of those flavors inside a sausage? Or the same thing when I was in Berlin, I had a street sausage with tomato.
And the currywurst.
Currywurst, yeah. Yeah. So I'm like, wonder if I could make a currywurst sausage where everything's inside it. And I went and dried, I don't know how many tomatoes, and ground them into powder and curry, and put the tomato powder and curry inside it. So that was one of the fails, by the way. It would have been interesting, but I think there's no way you can scale that up to 60 pounds unless you have 20 bushels of dehydrated tomatoes that you're freezing.
Well, and this is the amazing thing about sausage, is that it has historically been a place that just a lot of different stuff got shoved into a casing and then cooked. And it was a way to eat, sometimes not very high cuts of meat, sometimes not very interesting textures, but all packaged up together, and it becomes an interesting zone. And the reason, I mean, we're talking about sausages in the middle of an episode about pudding, you know, the sweet dessert that we think of in North America, or dessert in general, as they say in Britain. But pudding is also, you
know, blood pudding,
black pudding, white pudding, also in British English, are sausages. And the two, pudding, chocolate pudding, and pudding with banh mi flavorings inside, or borscht, come from the same root word. Then they are basically mixtures of some stuff, often something based on grains, mixed up with something that gives it flavor. And that turns it into like a sweet pudding in the case of plum pudding, but it turns it into a sausage in the case of, you know, meat and other flavorings, and maybe some filler like oats or other starchy
breadcrumbs.
So, you know, you don't do that. But that is like the common history of pudding and sausage. So it's just such a bizarre, you know, divergence in history between two things, one very sweet, one very savory, but that they share this sort of common identity. I was just wondering, whenever you're making sausages, do you ever think, I am participating in a long tradition of weird etymological changes, and here I am making a pudding that is not sweet, but savory?
Nope. No, I not necessarily about pudding and the word choice of those things, but certainly conscious of where sausage itself comes from and its uses, and the diversity of the fact that there's a different kind of pudding in your words for every culture in the world, you know, that come together in very different ways. It's just a way of using meat in a tube, but not always in a tube.
Meat in some encasement. Well, and the expression, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You've just described that to a T, right? You don't know how the sausage is going to be until you actually cook it and then eat it. So the proof is this thing cooked? Is this thing good? Well, you find out only afterwards. That's both the mystery and the excitement about making a sausage.
Yeah. And I think for me, that's also the idea of making and the excitement of trying something new and working it out, and figuring it out, and seeing whether it works. And then in the end, you're left with a sausage that you cook and you put in front of somebody. I mean, that's the most pleasurable thing. And of course, in the whole notion of the food chain, in the end, when you're eating everything and you're sharing that with a community, that's in the end the most important thing. It's way more important for me to have a whole pile of people running around my apartment talking to each other than it is of people walking away with sausages. It's like, I mean, it sounds a bit crazy. I'm making sausages and making the leap to this notion of community, but that's at the core of what I'm doing. And if I were just making sausages and then trying to sell them in a store or something, I wouldn't be very happy with what I was doing.
Well, I remember when you had made what you were calling poor man's botarga, that is the salted and dried, so cured egg yolks that you would then grate onto pasta. And I bought a few of them. They were truly some of the most amazing, small, tiny packages of joy that I've ever had in my fridge. But what
Thank
brought you to salt and dry egg yolks?
Because finding gray mullet roe to make real Botarga was pretty impossible. I did try and make real Botarga out of, here's another disaster, out of at the time I was smoking a lot of mackerel, and I got a bunch of mackerel that had the egg sacs still in there. Tried to make Botarga out of mackerel. Yeah, it was pretty nasty. No, it didn't happen. Yeah, it was just an idea. I think I saw it somewhere. Again, you know, I see things that sticks in my head and I go, oh, I could do this and I could change this. And so I think I'd seen someone just curing egg yolks and salt. That, well, what happens if you take salt and, you know, stick smoked paprika in the salt, or, you know, other aromatics, do a herb mix in the salt. Does that infuse the egg yolk? But it also trial and error, you know, first time you do it, you have your typical dozen eggs from industrial practice farms, horrible things, and you put the egg yolks in the salt, and variably the yolks break because the membranes are so thin. And so then you get some really good farm eggs and you're like, oh, this actually works. And by its nature, those farm eggs have better flavor just to begin with. And then, of course, when things are dried, that flavor is amplified.
Yeah. Well, I remember because I'd had Botarga in Italy, but the eggs were, that wasn't poor man's Botarga. That was lucky man's Botarga.
Yeah. And nowadays it's not poor man's Botarga because good eggs are $9 a dozen or something ridiculous. But yes. And then since then, a notion of drying other things. I remember I tried it with caraway and drying carrots in the salt and then grating those carrots as a kind of carrot salt. But it was a sort of intellectual trial and error. But since then, I've done stuff with heart. I'm actually about to try a giant beef heart that is grateable as a kind of meat Botarga.
But you know, once I was in Melbourne in Australia at this extraordinary restaurant, and they had that beef heart. They had a dried, cured beef heart on the counter, which they grated onto my dish. And I forget what dish it was again, but it was unbelievably good.
These things don't just happen in a moment of light bulb. They come from thinking about things like, oh, I've over-dried the jerky. Oh, wait, it's, what do I do? Oh, I could grate this jerky. There's things that happen that lead to these experiments and ideas. And they don't always work. As I've said, like, right. I had these pork kidneys. Let me see what happens if we dry kidneys and grate them. Oh, yes, I've got some piss on my... No, that's not going to happen again. But the other one that worked was liver, dried pork liver. I remember when I did a little meal for a bunch of people, the amuse-bouche, the first little dish was a riff on liver and onions. And so I did caramelized onions with grated cured liver and then some elderberry capers that I'd made from foraging elderberries. So it was like, it was really cool. But it's those kinds of things that are, for me, the joy of doing all those things. And it comes right back to this notion of the sausage. Same thing.
Yeah.
You know, experimenting with flavors and trying things and all that would work. And these two things go together in this particular kind of way normally. So what happens if I put that in a sausage and does that work?
Well, I'm so curious because in your professional life, you're a teacher and a photographer and you make visual stories and you show other people how to do that. But in your more private life, you're this incredible experimenter and cook. And I'm just curious, how do those two things come together for you? Are they just two separate parts of your life, or are they blended? Is it all part of one thing?
I think it's all, in a sense, it's all part of one thing because it's about process. And whether I'm teaching, whether I'm making stuff in the kitchen, whether I'm having a conversation with somebody, for me, the challenge, the beauty, the struggle, the desire is all about falling in love with the notion of process. And as a teacher, you're trying to do that with your students. You know, we live in a generation where everyone wants to go 0 to 100 in 5 minutes and they don't really care about the journey of getting there. They just care about getting marks at the end, how this is going to be amazing. And that's never the case. And the same thing in terms of making food. You know, it's like, oh, I can't cook. Well, how do you know you can't cook? Well, because every time I try and make something amazing, it's never amazing. Like, well, it's the first time you've ever tried to make it. So you got to screw it up a couple of times and learn what works and what doesn't work. So all of that for me comes down to this challenge of falling in love with the process of doing something. Teaching's the same. Making a visual story is the same. Cooking's the same. I think it's the notion of making. And if you take the idea of teaching and call that a kind of making as well, then the idea of process is part and parcel of it. Yeah. Proof's in the pudding.
There you go. So you wrapped up better than I ever could. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation about everything.
You're very welcome.
Hey, Maxime.
Hello, David.
I'm a little sad right now.
Why?
Because this is the last time I'm going to stick something in your mouth. For a while, anyway.
The whole concept of sticking something in Maxime's mouth is quite funny.
I know, but the kids love it.
Yes.
All right. So, but this is our last episode of this season one of Making Meal of It. So we're going out with style. We're going out with dessert.
Ooh, yay.
It's pudding time. What's your history with pudding?
Well, pudding is two things for me. Pudding chômeur, so this cake with syrup. And then you have pudding, which is this flan.
Yeah,
or
flan, custard.
Custard. So it's two things for me.
Yeah.
So when you say pudding, I never know what's going to come out of the oven.
Well, in Quebec, we have pudding. So it's P-O-U-D-I-N-G.
Yes.
P-U-D-D-I-N-G.
Yes.
And then there's also pudding, because we also do have like
yes.
chocolate pudding well, cups.
Of course, it was like the first thing I've ever made dessert-wise was a jello version of the pudding, whether it was vanilla or chocolate.
But in Quebec, a pudding is much more like a British pudding. That is, it's a steamed or baked dessert that is not based on milk or milk and eggs or milk and starch. So we've got these two different puddings.
Yes. But
pudding is a very, pudding's a fascinating word. I'm not going to make you talk about the etymology of it, but.
Nope. That's your department.
Because it also means like, you know, black pudding, white pudding. It means a meat sausage. It also means a sweet dessert. It also means just generically in England, it means dessert. And Quebec has inherited more the British version of steamed puddings or baked puddings than the American heritage of custardy puddings.
Yeah.
I mean, there's pudding chômeur, which means basically pudding for the non-working person. It's a very cheap dessert. But there are other pudding. Right?
Well, pudding aux petits fruits, so, you know, small berries. Yeah. But yeah, though, that's pretty much the extent of my pudding knowledge.
Well, then the pudding aux petits fruits, as you said, is a bit more like a charlotte, which is then French heritage creeping back in as well.
Yeah.
All right, so.
That's true.
Let's just have a little bit of pudding and talk
pudding.
About
so life. What is the flavor? And
well, this is
it,
chocolate.
Is it from a box?
It's not from a box, my dear. Do I ever make you anything out of a box?
No.
Sometimes.
Very rarely.
Yeah. So this is just chocolate pudding. It's a nice recipe that I've had for a while. Usually it's got egg yolks and cornstarch in it. So it's got two thickening agents. And then I put in some tonka bean that I grated on the microplane.
And chocolate or just
and
tonka bean?
Yeah, chocolate and tonka.
Yes. So chocolatey and gooey and
yum,
delicious.
I used to think chocolate pudding was God's gift to humanity.
Well, we had... For the longest time, prepared pudding by Laura Secor.
Oh, yes.
With René Simard as the
spokesperson.
The spokesperson. Et c'était les puddings du petit Simard.
Les puddings du petit Simard. When I was really lucky, my mother would buy us pudding cups, like Del Monte pudding cups.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But they were so disgusting. Mm-hmm. I mean, in retrospect or retrogust.
What I'm eating is very, very good, listener. Yeah.
Do you get the tonka bean in there?
I do get the tonka bean and the chocolate. There's a depth of flavor in there.
Yeah, and this is really good cocoa powder too. I mean, this is almost black. This
morning. Yeah, no, it's lovely. Very, very good.
So as we casually and quietly eat our pudding, what's this experience been like for you? Tasting things that sometimes you'd want to taste or making, you know, sitting down and talking to me in front of a microphone about your food history.
Excellent question.
When I originally asked you to do this, you said, sure. And then
I was a little hesitant when I learned I would have to eat some stuff I didn't like. And, you know, I still don't like bananas. But it's been fun. It was fun, you know, learning to be a bit more eloquent about food.
Has anything surprised you or will particularly stick in your mind from any of our tastings?
I don't necessarily have a particular memory of something other than the things I did not like.
Cheese
and banana.
Wet toast.
Yes. So it just reaffirmed that certain dislikes that I have are there to stay and will not change.
But some things did change, right?
Yes.
You tasted some things and you went, that's not so bad.
It's not so bad. But will I eat them in the future? That is the question.
Because I do seem to recall that you kind of liked the anchovy that you ate.
Yes, yes. I think it was a good thing. But will I reach for it next time when I see it, or it's, if it's on a menu, or I'm not sure.
Yeah, but if I put it on your side, niçoise, would you eat one?
Maybe. We'll test it next time.
And what about the fact that we talk about food quite a lot in our household. We're just not sitting in front of a recording device.
Well, I mean, it's a different setup, but it's the same conversation. Conversations.
I make stupid sexual innuendos and you laugh.
And I laugh. Or you make dad jokes and I laugh. And we eat good food.
Yeah, we do eat good food. We're very, very privileged in that way. Well, if you were to stick something in my mouth, food-wise, what would it be?
You don't really have any dislikes.
No, but what would you be interested in getting me to taste that maybe
I something you've not tasted before.
Something maybe from your childhood that I haven't tasted yet that you would like me to taste and think about and talk to you about. What would it be?
My mom's soups.
Oh, she made good soups.
She made good soups and she made them too thick. And I love it like that. She would always add one poignée of pasta too many. Mm-hmm. She would always wonder, is it enough? And then she would like panic and put one more. And I love it. I love that texture. And it's reminiscent of such. And she made good food. She made especially good soups.
Well, I suspect that you have inherited her fine touch with soups because I actually find your soups the best that I've ever eaten.
Well, thank you.
So keep panicking and throwing in that extra handful of pasta.
I try to rein it in, but
I will always stick your soup in my mouth.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup d'avoir participé au podcast, mon cher.
Well, it was my pleasure and it was really fun.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bon appétit.
Merci. Bye.
Bye. With more than a bit of embarrassment, I remember one school day many years ago when a couple of friends and I tried to make a Del Monte chocolate pudding cup explode on the ground by throwing it up in the air as high as we could and then letting it slam down onto the asphalt of our elementary school playground. I was probably in grade 4, so 9 or 10 years old, and we would have been on our lunch break. The pudding cup, included by my mother as a rare treat in my lunchbox, was made of aluminum rather than today's plastic, so it resisted our numerous attempts to get it to pop open, instead landing on the ground with a thud or a little bounce, denting and deforming, but not splitting open with the wow factor we so desired. We tried over and over, using different upward launching techniques, full body hoiks, followed by a snap of the wrist, spinning our arms like pinwheels and releasing the cup on the upward swoop, and even a vertical attempt to imitate our favorite pitchers from the Montreal Expos. Just before the school bell rang, calling us back inside, my friend Timmy, I think, gave the cup a final heave towards the heavens. It wasn't a very high shot, but when the by now very sad pudding projectile came down again, a fatigued metal seam must have finally come undone. Splot! And out of a small, jagged tear, a tongue of brownish, soft solid emerged. The three of us stood around the murdered pudding cup, disappointed with the lack of drama and, I suspect, a bit ashamed of what we had just done. In retrospect, I like to think of this episode as part of my early interest in gravity, projectile physics, and experimentation with food matter. That's probably an optimistic stretch, however. Mostly, I wonder why, after begging my mother for store-bought single-serve pudding, I would be so wasteful and destructive with it. Presumably, it was pretty gross to actually eat, and when served at room temperature after a morning in my locker, it was a lot more appealing to play with than to consume. Together, though, it all makes me think about the ways in which food activates our imaginations, but is also being perpetually undervalued as cultural and bodily nourishment. Food is both boring and ordinary, as well as magnificent and exceptional. And, you know, that's why I believe it's worth making a meal of, in many senses. So rounding out this season of the podcast with pudding was sort of intentional and sort of not. Sure, as dessert, it should come at the end of the meal. And it's also playful and kid-like, which can be a nice note to bring things to a close on. But after talking with Richard and Nick about their different yet similar takes on sweet and savory puddings, I've started to think that pudding is a pretty complex concept. It's a soft solid, as Richard pointed out, firm enough not to flow under standard pressure, yet liquid enough to go splot under other conditions, like in a frat house wrestling pit, for example, or on a school playground. So in that sense, pudding, the chocolate custardy stuff, that is, kind of exists between two states of being, not solid, not liquid, but also both. In a similar way, Nick's sausages are puddings in an etymological sense, but they're also puddings in that they exist in multiple states. They are relational devices around which people gather. They're recipes to be followed and opportunities for improvisation. They come from singular cultures, yet they traverse many. They are, like their sweet cousins, transnational and transtemporal, and they find their proofs only in the eating. All this makes me think that pudding is perhaps representative of queerness in some ways when it comes to the form and nature and beingness of food. Non-binary, trans, gastrofluid, resistant to either-or definitions, emblematic of impurity and pluralism. Over the course of its existence in French, the word pudding has been both female and male gendered, changing at least once over its linguistic history. That's super rare for words, where gender is generally anchored to a very long timeline. And as destabilizing as that might be for some folks, pudding's fluidity might be yet another brick in the foundation of a new way of understanding plurality. Could pudding be one of the foods that can help us upend the domination of cis heteronormativity and move towards greater acceptance and celebration of inclusivity and queerness? I would definitely be making a meal of pudding, but why not? Things change, after all, and food tends to be the starting point for many a revolution. Over the course of these 16 episodes of Making a Meal of It, several respondents to the food questionnaire took advantage of my final prompt in which I asked them to offer up an additional query, either directed at future respondents or at me. I've decided to interpret these questions as being for me, and so for this edition, it's yours truly responding. So thank you to Sandeep Bhagwati, John Schreiner, Amita Kuttner, ChatGBT, Don Lee, Terrace Gresko, Bruce LaBruce, and Elizabeth Santo for their provocative and thoughtful questions. When I recorded my answers to the questionnaire, I was feeling grateful, tired, and relatively relational. From composer, conductor, and teacher Sandeep Bhagwati.
Which mountain did you have to bite your way through before you found your paradise? Or are you still chewing?
I think I'm very definitely still chewing, and will do so as long as I can. But when I was a preteen, I had a dream that I was sailing through a sandwich, and that the meats and cheeses and lettuces and mayonnaise were valleys and hills and streams and cliffs. I think that's the landscape I will always be in, taking bites as I go, but never biting all the way through it. From medical physicist John Schreiner.
What particular mashup of ethnic foods from different countries has made a memorable meal for you?
The interconnections and through lines that are so distinctive of food make it hard for me to think of different dishes as really coming from different countries or being mashable up. That said, one of my friend groups sometimes comes together for big potluck food fests, often on Jewish holidays, despite the fact that only two of us are Jews. And eating diasporic Jewish food, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, Mizrahi, and North American, all made by people of very different backgrounds, is actually kind of a mashy pleasure for me. Very different foods often, but also with a bunch of common sensory and conceptual elements. From astrophysicist and former Green Party of Canada leader, Amita Kuttner.
What fruit or vegetable were you surprised to find out how it grows?
Figs. That they are co-evolutionary and codependent with fig wasps for their life cycles is fascinating to me. Everybody should read about fig wasps on Wikipedia. From artificial intelligence chatbot, ChatGPT.
If you could share a meal with any historical figure, who would it be, and what dish would you serve him?
Am I surprised that ChatGPT asked me this rather cliche question? No. However, I will answer it. I would dine with my four grandparents, who all knew me as a cook in their lifetimes, but not as the food adult that I have now become. So I would ask each of them for a dish they would like me to make, and thus compose our five-person meal. Conversation would take its own course. From artist and designer Don Lee.
How do you want to change the world with food?
I want food to be the starting point for reinventing relationships that are caring, mutually beneficial, and reverential. From author and food historian, Taras Gresko.
Where do you get the nerve, sir? Tell me.
Well, it is innate, sir. I've had it all along. From filmmaker and provocateur, Bruce LaBruce.
What is your favorite extreme cuisine? What is the food that made you barf as a child?
I love offal. It scares and delights me. Is it extreme? Maybe not so much, except Andouillette. And the only thing I remember making me barf as a child was a lukewarm orange soda on the train from Toronto to Montreal, and I never drank it again. From union organizer and podcaster sister, Elizabeth Santo.
What smallish change can the average person make that would contribute to making food systems more balanced?
I think if each of us could pay real and deep attention to our mundane food acts, even just once a day, and wonder about and extrapolate and figure out their effects on other people, other places, and other times, that will inspire and create the change that needs to happen. So that's it. Making a Meal of It, Season 1, out. We have covered a fair bit of ground over the past weeks, going from philosophy to pudding while traversing the realms of fat and fermentation and fish and sugar and selling and systems. We've ducked in and out of kitchens and restaurants and forestry foraging grounds, and we've considered power and privilege and sustainability. So thank you, dear listener, for sampling all of these tastes, both material and conceptual, and for going along with it as I interpreted the themes of each show quite broadly. I may not know who you are, but hopefully you have a better sense of your own food self and the ways that you want to keep relating to and reimagining food culture and food systems. My sincere gratitude to Richard Hartel and Nick Amberg for going with the pudding flow in our conversations and for helping to make this episode both an endpoint for the season and maybe the start of a new direction. I also want to thank some very key people who helped enormously at the start of this process, Damian Piper and Amanda DiBattista, podcasters and media makers themselves, whose guidance has been invaluable, as well as Nick and Ben at Story Mode for the podcast's distinctive sounds and music. And of course, merci infiniment to the man who suggested I make a meal of it in the first place. The one with whom I enjoy aperitivo nearly every night, the munificent and genial Maxime Giroux. May your mouth always be full, mon amour. Finally, it's back to you. Let me know via social media what you've been liking and what you'd like more of. Whether it's food and knowledge and more podcasting noise or another kind of nourishment that can be created with activism and action and social movements. Whatever your appetite is for change or stability, there are plenty of folks out there who are helping to make things better when it comes to food, justice, deliciousness, tradition, identity, equity, and hope. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, enjoy your meal and bottoms up.